Welcome to episode 1+ of season 2 of Slow Burn. I am Leon Nafok, and in these special bonus episodes, I'm going to tell you more about what I found while researching this season of Slow Burn. Because it's weird to ask yourself questions and then answer them, I have here to help me out my wonderful colleague, Mary Wilson, who will be my co-host on this season.
Hi, Leon. Great to be here.
Hey, Mary. Thanks for doing this with me.
I'm very excited to be here.
So if you're listening to this, you already know that these episodes are only available to Slate Plus members. But if you like these bonus episodes, please tell your friends and family to sign up for Slate Plus.
Later in the bonus episode, we are going to hear your interview with the makers of a fictionalized web series about Monica Lewinsky. But before we get to that, I have some questions about the first episode and the new season. So season one of Slow Burn was Slow Burn, a podcast about Watergate.
Yes.
Season two, there's no subtitle.
No subtitle.
The author deep inside you has dropped the publisher's need for a subtitle. Does that mean you guys have arrived? You guys are big?
Oh, I think what it reflects is that we hope to do more of these. It's just easier to just call it Slow Burn and have it be whatever we want it to be in the future. You know, we called the first one a podcast about Watergate because we felt like that would be a good way for people to find it. But we don't want to rename it every time we put out a new season. So we're going to keep it simple.
Okay, that sounds good. So talk to me, is it harder to tell the story of the impeachment of President Bill Clinton? Is it harder to tell that story than it was to tell the story of the Watergate investigation?
Unequivocally, yes, for a number of reasons. One is that there's just a lot more plot to get through. You know, Watergate was one scandal. To explain how the impeachment of Bill Clinton came about, you have to work your way through probably a dozen scandals. Maybe a dozen is overshooting it, but there's so many that sort of built up and created a chain reaction, so to speak, that kind of inexorably led to the sort of conclusion of the story. But, you know, nailing down each of those scandals, nailing down the facts of each of those scandals is hard. You know, there are a lot more caveats in this story. There are a lot more asterisks that you want to, you know, that you want to put in as you're writing a script, because there's so many more disputed facts. There's just more complexity, I think, because with Clinton, you know, you're dealing with someone who has a very unsettled legacy, especially right now as we are going through the Me Too movement, especially now as we're approaching the 20th anniversary. Or I guess we've already approached it. I think if depending on how you count 1998, sort of when the Lewinsky part of the story, the Monica Lewinsky part of the story starts.
Wait, who is celebrating that anniversary?
Well, I don't think anyone's celebrating it. I just think it's like...
it's just like in the press.
It's just in the press. Yeah, I feel okay. Like, you know, I suspect there's going to be other sort of reassessments of Clinton out in the world soon. Mm. You know, and that just makes I think it puts a little bit of pressure on us to try to situate what we are doing sort of in the context of the discourse around Clinton. And that's a complicated discourse. And I think in the end, our ambition is to try to kind of explain where everyone was coming from. You know, not just Clinton, but also Ken Starr. Not just Ken Starr, but also Monica Lewinsky. Not just Monica Lewinsky, but all the people who, you know, were at home reacting to this story as it unfolded. You know, why did the Republicans do what they did? Why did the Democrats do what they did? Why did feminists do what they did? And to sort of get back to your question as to whether it's harder, it feels to me like there are more perspectives to take into account than there were the first time around.
Okay, this is the fun part for me. What did you have to leave out of this episode?
Well, so the main thing that I wish we could have found room for, and one of the big controversies about what happened on January 16th, 1998, has to do with whether Monica Lewinsky was discouraged from calling a lawyer by the FBI, by the prosecutors who were talking to her. She has said that she was. And it's hard to adjudicate this, but from everything I've read, I gather that she was. She was told basically that a lawyer would make things more complicated. And the very specific reason why the prosecutors told her that is that her lawyer was someone they didn't trust. So Lewinsky was basically given a lawyer, or she was set up with a lawyer by Clinton's friend Vernon Jordan. And as people who heard the episode know, sort of the big thing that the prosecutors had on Lewinsky was an affidavit that she had written and signed in which she denied having any kind of affair with Clinton. The problem was that this affidavit had been prepared with Frances Carter with her lawyer. And so the prosecutors thought, well, this guy, Frances Carter, is in on it. He's in on this conspiracy. He is someone who helped her lie. He knew what he was doing. And he was told to do this by Vernon Jordan, or he was told to do this, you know, not literally by Bill Clinton, but they suspected that he was in on it. And they didn't want to tip off Clinton to their investigation. They didn't want people to know. And they thought that if Monica Lewinsky were to call Frances Carter and have him come, you know, be her representative or whatever, it would sort of blow up their spot. And so at one point, you know, they tried to suggest, well, you know, maybe you can call a different lawyer. You know, here's a number for, a legal aid lawyer. But she didn't want to do that. And, you know, and this is a big problem. I mean, you know, if you're being questioned by federal prosecutors, you want a lawyer there. And, you know, there's a line somewhere now, I can't remember where I read this, but Lewinsky says, this is very simple. Like, I was there for 11 hours. I didn't have a lawyer at any point. Why? I'm not stupid. Like, I get that you want that. I did want a lawyer there and I didn't have one. So you tell me what happened. You know, and I think the truth is probably a little more complicated than that. Like, what does discouraged mean? Mm-hmm. Was she forbidden, you know, from calling her lawyer? You know, probably not forbidden. But at a certain point, if a federal prosecutor is discouraging you from doing something, you know, it amounts to the same thing. So that was something we had in an earlier draft of the show. Another related thing is that the affidavit that she, in which she denied having an affair with Clinton, mm-hmm. had never actually been submitted yet to the court. It was like in the mail. it had not yet been like processed, you know. So one wonders, like, well, so what does it mean that she signed a false affidavit if it hasn't been filed with the court yet? Because her lawyer had I think literally put it in the mail that day. And the reason that the prosecutors from Ken Starr's office had it was because they got it from lawyers for Paula Jones. So they knew about it, but technically it hadn't yet been filed. So she hadn't really committed a crime. Like, those 27 years that they threw at her, you know, about, you know, this penalty for perjury. What perjury had she committed? She hadn't yet filed the affidavit. She meant to. She signed it. She was going to. But she hadn't at that point. And, you know, maybe that's another reason they didn't want to call her a lawyer, because if they had, they would have lost that leverage, because he would have said, well, great, we're not going to file this affidavit. So that's another important point that we had in an earlier draft that we had to cut, just because it's too complicated. And even as I tell you the story now, it's like, mm-hmm. you got to explain exactly what happened. You could be like, well, see, Paula Jones's lawyers had the affidavit because X, and they gave it to the Star team under Y circumstances. And it's just like, it gets to a point where you just have to kind of gloss over it and find a way to tell the story without going down each of those little alleyways.
I want to ask you about Bruce Udoff and mm-hmm. something he says early in the episode. He says, you know, we had been planning this confrontation with Monica Lewinsky, but we were not prepared for her personality. Mm-hmm. We didn't expect her to be a shrinking violet, but we certainly were not prepared.
Yep.
You talked to him. I mean, what surprised him? What surprised all of them?
I think they were just hoping it would be a lot easier to convince her to do this. You know, I think they were just hoping that they could get it done pretty quickly. They weren't expecting her to resist to the extent that she did. And I think they didn't think through how much emotion it would provoke in her, and how freaked out she would become. You know, and I hope this comes through in the episode. She was really in a state for a lot of this. You know, she calmed down at certain points. Obviously, like when she's at Crate and Barrel, like cracking jokes with Mike Emick, she's a little calmer. But, you know, for big stretches of this day, she was crying and thinking of suicide and just was really, I think, hard to communicate with. You know, these guys were sort of like, they didn't know what to do with her. They didn't know how to calm her down. They didn't know how to talk her down from this panic that she was feeling. And I think it's surprising that they didn't anticipate her panic, because how else was she going to react? You know, like, I think, as Renata Adler says, you know, who would not be scared by this?
Right. Right. It's weird that the group of guys who were like, let's not show her cop shows on TV because she might hear a snitch.
That's a great point. There's a little inconsistency there. I wish I had more insight into kind of what they were thinking. But I thought one thing that's worth underscoring is how fast all this was moving. You know, like, they'd found out about...
The
prosecutors had found out about the Clinton Lewinsky affair like days before this. You know, they weren't... They had meetings
because they were talking to the civil suit lawyers.
Yeah, they found out. Well, yeah, they found out from the a lawyer who was working for Paula Jones.
Was that shady that they were talking to those lawyers or no?
It's a matter of dispute.
Okay.
How shady it was. You know, I think this is something we'll get into in future episodes, but there was just a lot of steps that they took between when they when they first got the tip about Monica Lewinsky to when they got word from Linda Tripp and they met with her and kind of, you know, tried to figure out whether she was telling the truth. And if so, what evidence she had. It was all very fluid and it moved very fast.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Leon, the next thing we're going to do is play your interview with the makers of a web series about Monica Lewinsky's life after the scandal. Is this something I should watch?
Yeah, I definitely recommend it. It's a comedy, but it's sort of also a sad comedy. I guess it's one of those not very funny comedies, but it has a lot of great qualities. And it's called Monica. It came out in 2015, and there are, I believe, 9 episodes. We'll include a link in the show notes where you can stream it. Basically, this is a show that imagines Lewinsky's life in 2001, so after the scandal, when she was 27 and trying to live a normal life in New York City. So the show follows her as she, you know, walks around Central Park, tries to, you know, make herself invisible in the street as she goes on dates. And it's very kind of deeply felt and poignant and just all around a unique portrayal of this person that I think a lot of us have an abstract view of. But actually, there was a more specific reason I wanted to have them on the show, and specifically on this bonus episode, which is that in the last 3 episodes that they made, there are flashbacks throughout. And the flashbacks are to January 16th, 1998, which is the day that is covered in this first episode of Slow Burn. So apart from recommending the show to our members, I was also just excited to talk to the creators about how they render the events of that day and sort of compare notes with them about how we each sort of brought that day to life. And they didn't talk to her either, you know, which sort of puts us in a similar predicament that we had a great discussion about.
And so who are we about to hear from?
So the interview is with filmmaker Daron Max Haggai, and he was joined in our studios by Lily Murata, who co-created the show with him and played Monica Lewinsky in the series. So yeah, they came in, we had a great conversation, and I hope everyone likes it.
Awesome.
All right, so I'm here with Daron Haggai and Lily Murata, and they are the creators of a wonderful web series called Monica that came out in 2015. And I've been so excited to talk to them because I feel like we both kind of had to absorb this very specific part of history, and we did it in different ways. So I'm excited to talk to you guys. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So excited to be here, Leon.
Thank you. So tell me why you guys wanted to revisit Monica Lewinsky when you did. I mean, 2015 is, you know, it was a somewhat different time. What made you curious about her, and how did you find each other?
Well, we found each other through our interest in Monica, which I think is rare because probably, like, most people in, like, I don't know, 2011 aren't, like, so obsessed with Monica Lewinsky. And I think for me, and I don't know, maybe Daron, it's like it was the seminal scandal of our childhood. So, like, you know, just what was on TV and anytime you're at the grocery store, like, Monica was there, like, on the Inquirer or on TV. So that was, like, such a memory of my childhood. And I think I've always, like, been into political and celebrity scandal.
I think my interest in Monica stems from having discovered Monica in Black and White.
Okay.
And I was really...
Tell our listeners what that is, because yes. I think it's actually a weirdly obscure title now.
Yes. So it's an HBO documentary that Monica produced in 2001. I was really struck by it, and I was struck by what she was narrativizing about the experience. So despite the scandal being a very felt thing in my childhood, I feel like it didn't really hit me until I watched Monica in Black and White.
Mm-hmm.
I, you know, was kind of like running around with, like, you know, kind of asking everyone I knew if they had seen it.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed like most people hadn't even heard of it.
Yeah.
That really struck me because I was so taken with it. And I became really fascinated with Monica.
Yeah. The thing that makes me think about is that there's not really like a defining cultural work about this scandal. Mm-hmm. Like, the, you know, we, when we did the Watergate season, we sort of knew we were sort of, we were like going to meet people roughly in the neighborhood of All the President's Men, which like most people have seen. And like, for most people, that's the main sort of source of their knowledge of what that scandal was all about. With the Clinton scandal, I feel like if you were you know, sort of an adult who was paying attention then, you remember it quite vividly, or maybe parts of it quite vividly. Mm-hmm. But if you're like us and, you know, you weren't quite sentient, or at least not paying attention when it all blew up, there hasn't really been like a kind of, what would you call it? Like a, yeah, just like a definitive kind of treatment of the story that has, you know, brought it out to the general population.
Mm-hmm. I think because probably it was so overdone at the time with like SNL and late night talk shows that like either people were like over it, and I think they were, you know, just like, okay, maybe we've talked about this enough.
Mm-hmm.
But that was also like, to us, we were like, well, no one's made really anything about Monica, especially no one's made anything about Monica after the scandal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which was the coolest part to us. It was like, we've seen everything in the beret and the blue dress, but like, no one's talked about her just like in 01, mm-hmm. you know, just trying to pick up the pieces.
And 01 was when she moved to New York City from, was it LA that she was before it?
See, that's where we took creative license.
Okay.
Right. She was in LA before.
But we have no idea.
Okay.
We assume.
Where she was before, you have no idea. Yeah.
We have no idea, but we assume because her dad has a house there.
Right.
I think her brother lives there.
We tried to match it.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Like, we know she got an apartment
yeah.
in the West Village.
Right.
Like, around 2001.
Yeah. I guess the reason why we said it after the scandal,
yeah.
like, there were many reasons, but one of the central reasons was for producibility. We really felt like
we could do 01.
We could yeah. do 01.
And, like, we don't have to, right, it's not, obviously, we self-produced it. We weren't going to, like, try to recreate a White House.
Right.
Like a really cheap looking. Like,
which would have been really cool.
Would have been great. And I was saying, but it also I think I like 01 for me is, that's like my favorite era of rom-coms.
Okay.
And Monica to me is just like the best friend in the rom-com that you don't see the story of. Like, she's like great, but then she's like going home and crying, and like, you know, you're just seeing Kate Hudson like kissing, you're not seeing like the sad brunette, you know, walking with a froyo crying in the West Village.
Okay, this is all new to me.
Okay.
So how would you say Monica was sort of seen when you guys were putting this out? Like, what was her sort of place in the sort of cultural imagination? I know that's vague, but like, what was your sense of kind of her valence, I guess, as a figure?
That she was like a joke of yesteryear, like a forgotten joke. People are like, oh, like, you know, haha, like Molly Shannon, you know, blue dress, come. But everyone was like, what is she doing now? Where is she?
Yeah, and I feel like at the time she was just marked by all of her failed attempts at kind of correcting her image.
Like the handbags.
The handbags. The weird...
She'd started a handbag design
yes.
company,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Yes, which are incredible objects if you think about it, because they really are a product of trauma. They're like quilted, they're objects to, you know, in hopes of salvation. But yeah, you know, all these failed attempts, she was...
There was a reality show, right?
See, there was weird hosting gigs.
Yeah. Yeah, Mr. Personality.
Oh, yeah, not a reality show. It was like a game show.
It was like a dating show.
Mm-hmm. She did a lot of stuff that would, I think, have aired, had it been like present day, would have aired on Taxi TV.
Okay.
Like, there's postcards from, what was it?
Oh, Postcards from Monica.
Yeah, where she like goes
which is
to
amazing.
Like, she goes to like spas.
Okay.
And she's like, I mean, she's charismatic.
And that for me, yeah, it. Like, it's, if you watch... out there, watch Postcards from Monica, because it shows like how joyful she can be, and which is what attracts me to her, of just, I guess, in that combo of tragedy, because you just see her like laughing at a spa, and then you just think about her life and
yeah,
kind of what she's gone through and like what she's like pushing herself to do, to be like, I'm hosting and putting on a nice bathrobe and really trying to do something that will distract you from what you know me from, but also what the culture like put. That's in a way like that's in America. I feel like that's your only option if something really scandalous happens to you. Like you can't get a normal job, so you just have to become a weird host and make a line or you know host a weird dating show.
You have to somehow if not capitalize on your trauma or your notoriety, but you do have to parlay it into your next act or whatever.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So hearing you guys talk about her right now, like it's so abundantly clear, and it's clear from the show too that you have a whole ton of affection for her. You admire her. And I think like most people sort of in our milieu would like identify with that. You know, they would like at this point they would I don't know. I feel like everyone I know would at least be inclined to see her as not just someone who got a raw deal, mm-hmm. but also like someone who has sort of heroic qualities, right?
Totally.
What changed? Mm-hmm. I mean, like what between the time when, you know, she was the joke of yesteryear, Lily, as you put it, what switched?
And I think how people see feminism and like sex and like much more of a, I don't know, like a second wave feminism was probably present in the 90s. And people loved Clinton so much. I mean, I feel like including my parents, but I don't think they really hate on Monica. But, I mean, people love Clinton and it's that sort of thing of, like, blame the woman. Mm. And they could just be, like, slut. Whereas now, if this happened, it's like, you know, the Jezebel feminist media would be defending her in a second.
Mm. I wonder, you know, it's interesting because it was just felt. It was like suddenly it dawned on me that she was so gravely mistreated, mm-hmm. you know? I really don't know if it's because of, you know, where my head was at in 2012 or 11 when I first watched Monica in Black and White. Maybe I was just like kind of where my head was at, my point of view just kind of like led me to kind of suddenly realize that there was this person in the media landscape who is this kind of amazing, like, cipher for mm-hmm. so much like misogyny and like political corruption and the kind of like rampant weird materialism in the culture, and just suddenly she felt like this kind of central point of reference for a lot of really interesting ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, when we made the show, there was no mention of a kind of like political project. We just like wanted to
We
just wanted to humanize her, you know? And I think both of us are just like, it goes without saying, feminists, you know? We couldn't imagine a more boring approach to depicting Monica than simply parody. Like,
right.
or offensive. Imagine if...
And that wouldn't have felt new. Yeah. That wouldn't have felt new, obviously, to anyone, since that was the main way in which she'd been
right.
portrayed.
Right, if we were like, let's create a mad TV skit from 99.
I mean, that's still a fear when I take meetings with people, and I've done a bunch of stuff since Monica, but Monica comes up inevitably. And uh-huh. I really do feel like sometimes the subtext in the room is that it's like, oh, so you made a parody about Monica.
Because it's a comedy.
It's a comedy.
Because like, John Early and Kate Berland are in it, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. And so it's like the nightmare of being in a room with someone who thinks we made a comedy about Monica.
And is like psyched about that.
Yeah, yeah, like a shitty comedy. Like yeah. Making fun of her. I'm like, and it's psyched. I'm like, it's pure terror.
Yeah.
But
I can imagine that.
And I think what people don't know, since no one's watched Postcards from Monica, is that like she has a sense of humor. It's like she's not just a tragic person or a joke, and it's like, right, we can make a comedy about Monica where she is like laughing with people without it being mm-hmm. a full parody.
Right.
There are things about Monica that are funny.
Yeah.
I think you saw on SNL or Matt TV or whatever have you, I think you saw like, you saw those things that are funny about her exploded, and in the process, kind of like all the nuance of her personality kind of was erased.
Yeah.
And our show we're trying to embrace what's funny about Monica.
Yeah.
The things that are silly about her.
Yep.
While also, and using comedy, because we're interested in comedy, using comedy as a means of having an audience identify with her experience and having an audience connect with her humanity mm-hmm. in a way that we thought at the time no one had attempted to do.
I think it's also true that, I think you were just getting at this, like to go in the opposite direction entirely and make her just a purely tragic figure who was, you know, 100% victimized in the situation. I think that would also sort of take away a layer of complexity from her, right?
Like, I really hoped, yeah, I guess like playing her, I was like, I don't want to just be like, okay, so here's a ruined woman. The whole point, I feel like, that we try to show is that she was really trying to survive and like trying to have fun and have that mix of like, you know, she can't get away from her past, but she's trying, you know, her hardest to live this normal, fun life.
That was the recipe. It was like for the show, it was like, this is a comedy, but underneath the comedy is the story of a woman who is really trying to get more from her life. It's like, it's very much all about her kind of constantly realizing and coming up against forces that are telling her, no, you are forever the Monica that was, you know, depicted in the media, whatever, in 98, 99.
Yeah.
And that was like that's like the
right recipe for a show.
Yeah, that was the underpinning of it.
You know, classic, like the park episode with Caperland. It's like Monica's trying to have, you know, a fun day out where she's getting smoothies and hot dogs, but
and then in the end, Central Park. Yeah.
She's in Central Park and just like, oh, you know, hills. And then it's like, no, she's called a whore by the end of the day.
Right.
How are you? How does it feel to be here?
The park's good. Enjoy your day in the park.
You know, I used to know a girl like you. She was a whore. And she ruined the lives of everyone around her. And then nobody wanted her.
Well, thanks for the fable, but I gotta go.
You don't know what's coming for you. Do you?
I'm going.
I wanted to talk about the flashbacks in the second season. Because they're the only ones, and you mentioned earlier that, you know, if you guys maybe had had unlimited money, you might have flashbacked more, flashed back more. But you chose that day, and I'm curious why, because obviously, I chose that day too as sort of the center point for our first episode, and I'm curious to hear why you guys zeroed in on it and what you feel like that part of the story tells us.
Well, I think, and you say it. In the first episode, you say, I mean, it's clear that that's the day that kind of marked her trajectory going forward. You know, it was the day that she, I think, experienced the first kind of bit of horror that would then plague her, you know, for the years after.
Yeah.
And then in doing the research, it was like a lot of stuff emerged that was like, oh, this is really, this will be ripe for depiction on screen for like a kind of a dramedy. Like, we didn't have a budget to go to the mall, but we did decide that, you know, the way we would represent it was through a Chinese food meal, you know, where they're just like these two basically like her like attackers, essentially. She's like breaking bread with them.
Let's change the topic.
What do you think you'd have as your last meal? I'd have Chinese.
That's easy. Veal. Of course, go on out of on a high note.
I don't know, macaroni and cheese.
Nice. I'll get that.
It seemed like it would be a really rich day to depict.
Yeah.
Right, it's like the start of history. I mean, she lost her like main confidant and friend, Linda Tripp. And I just love the image of her like sitting in a food court by a Panda Express with like FBI agents like coming down as it's just, again, that's such a cinematic moment, which we don't have, but
could you imagine if we had the money though?
Oh, I know.
What did you guys think of when you heard Bruce Udolph reflecting on this day? I'm curious to hear your reactions to him.
Yeah, I was really just struck by someone, by learning that there was someone in the room who just had a sense that this wasn't right.
It was kind of a relief.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, there was someone right who wasn't just, who was like, that wasn't right to just like threaten Monica with 27 years and be so mean to her.
And I think what he had said at the very end of the show, which is like that we would, that the country or the council would stoop so low as to even try to use a 24-year-old to further its, you know, agenda is crazy. And I think that there's something really powerful about that, like about that, acknowledging like what the limits or lack thereof are with regards to the political machine.
Yeah.
You know?
And the legal machine and how they intersect.
Right.
Right, that she was just a pawn, obviously, for something else bigger, but whatever they can do, you know. And it's easy because they knew she wasn't, you know, going to be lawyered up in a second. And they're like, this is a weak target that we can just grab.
Mm-hmm. The thing that the show reminded me of is that it is unbelievable that she refused to wire up.
That she would have the strength to say no?
The strength to say no. 24 years old, being threatened with 27 years in jail, and still she, like, in many ways stood her ground and didn't cooperate. There should be a statue of her.
She also really was in love with Clinton.
Absolutely. I think she was, yeah. And I don't think people really grasped this during the scandal, that she actually had zero interest in exposing the relationship, despite
she did tell a lot of people about it.
She told a lot of people about it, but I don't think she had any
interest. I think because she was so into him. It wasn't can you believe I'm sleeping with the president? It was like, I'm so excited about this guy.
And at other points in the relationship, I was like, I'm so in such anguish over this because he was, you know, he was like keeping her at arm's length and not letting, you know, he had promised her that he would bring her back into the White House after the election. He didn't. And I think, you know, that for most of 97, she was in, you know, she was in agony.
Right. He had promised that after he was she was moved to the Pentagon, right?
Yes.
Because his cabinet was like, he needs to focus.
Right.
You're a distraction here in the White House.
That's right.
And he was like, I will bring you back to the White House once I'm reelected.
Yeah.
And then it was radio silence from him. And that's when she started spilling her guts to Linda.
Yep.
Yeah.
I find it so relatable, like the feeling of being led on by someone, you know, you're in love with. Like, mm-hmm. I just, obviously, my life has not included anything remotely of this gravity, but you know, just like having a crush on someone who's like stringing you along, you know,
right? It's
like,
they're buying you presents and then calling you and then moving you to the Pentagon.
Right.
I mean, but tale as old as time.
The feeling when you're moved to the Pentagon.
It's also, I don't know if you guys saw this. It was like a month ago or something. Clinton finally commented on it. You know, you have been like Me Too'd about Monica? And he gave such a like non-apology or something.
I think what he said was like, look, I apologized. And they were like, did you to her? Or did you just apologize?
To the country at a press conference.
He's like, well, she's part of the country. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It was
Which in a way it's like so classic, like dumb boyfriend move. Just like, what? So sorry.
She's part of the country.
She heard it. I told her friend.
Yeah, I was really surprised that he didn't have something better prepared. I was sort of shocked that like a politician of his sort of world famous grace and charisma like didn't have something better in his pocket.
He should feel so proud to be associated with Monica. That's my new stance. She's great. He doesn't deserve her name and his legacy.
Well, let me ask you one last thing. It's something I sort of wrestled with while working on this first episode and the show as a whole. You know, I didn't talk to Monica. I had to rely sort of on secondary sources and the, you know, things she said over the years. But I didn't talk to her. And, you know, we wanted to make sure like people could hear her voice, which is why we included that little clip from her 2014 Forbes speech.
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious whether you guys felt any misgivings about sort of intervening on her story, I guess. Was there any part of you that felt like you were, you know, telling a story that didn't feel like yours?
I think so. When we started making the show, she was like utterly absent from the culture. And then about a month before we released the episodes, her first article with Vanity Fair appeared. And she basically...
What was sort of the gist of the article, if you could remind our listeners?
Yeah, that basically when she moved to... After the scandal, basically what the show's about, that she couldn't get a job.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, there was no such thing as a normal life as Monica Lewinsky after the scandal. and coming to terms with that. And I actually like avoided the article because I didn't want to. And I remember getting a lot of emails from people and friends being like, "Oh my God, this is the best! Like, this could not be a better time for you to put out a show." And I felt very differently about it. I felt like, "Oh, it kind of took the wind. What's the saying? The wind from our sails,
yeah.
Kind of, because you know, there's no way that we could tell her story better than she could, and amazingly, kind of actually, there was a lot of stuff that she said that." I feel like we just kind of guessed.
Yeah.
And we were like, whoa, she's confirming a lot of what we suspected.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess also just to answer that question again, it's like we knew going into it our intentions were pure.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to make people feel for Monica. Mm-hmm. And we never – the idea was never to represent her as a joke or
yep.
as someone who – in any negative way, really. I mean, we went into it maybe like to a fault, kind of trying to lionize her. So yeah, so that never, it never, I was never like, you know.
Felt like we were caught or something like that. Like, oh, you caught us trying to.
Yeah, or like I was like, oh, you know, she may never hear of this. No one may ever see this. The attempt was to make something that respected her.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, everyone asked me, you know, has Monica seen it? Has Monica heard about it? And I heard through, I think, a series of gays that she had heard about it, and I don't know if she watched it or watched the first episode, but I think she kind of made a Monica like S joke, just like, oh, you hear there's like the web series about me now.
I heard that she, source will go unnamed, but that when she found out, was like pleased that it was about the period after the scandal.
Mm. Yeah.
And thought that was interesting. What would we do if it came out that she was like, I just don't like it? And I don't love it.
Not funny.
not funny or interesting.
Hate
or smart
it.
Or cool.
Yeah.
I think we'd take it down. And honestly, I think it would be good for the show.
Yeah, then we could sell it, you know?
Yeah.
Thank you.